So we have a discussion period now for anyone who would like to bring anything up for discussion or like to ask any questions at all. Please feel free to do so. Yes. Yeah, so the wholesome kind of desire, which has the technical term, the technical name of chanda or kusala chanda or dhamma chanda. To backtrack a little bit, the word chanda itself in Buddhist psychology is not an exclusively positive term. It basically means the will towards, but here it's used in its meaning of the will towards either goodness or truth. So those are the two objects of this form of desire. So the urge to understand, to penetrate the truth of things, the urge to act with kindness and compassion, with wisdom, and so on, in one's life, and that sense of being inspired by goodness. I think that's something that you many people will be familiar with. That when one begins to follow a spiritual path in whatever way, then one's appreciation of the beauty of goodness, even in its quite mundane everyday manifestations, becomes much enhanced. And just a small act of kindness, seeing a child helping another child to his feet after he's fallen over, or something just as everyday as that, can almost bring tears to your eyes. And it's as if the eyes have been opened or cleansed, as it were. And the extent to which you see and are impressed by and inspired by goodness, then that's to that degree then you try to incorporate that in your life, and the extent to which you're willing to make sacrifices for that without expecting anything in return. One of the most commonly referred to taught groups of dhammas that the Buddha is called the four paths to success, as it's called, and it's the teaching which is most commonly used when monks talk about education and give talks to school children, because it's considered to be the virtues that a school child or a student should endeavor to develop within themselves. And the first one of those is chanta, or is that will towards study. And I think in this particular case, you can see again the connection to wisdom and intelligence, in the sense of finding ways to enjoy studying. That's very significantly the first one of this group. Because if you think that what you're studying or your job or anything is a chore and you don't enjoy it, then you're always sort of going against the grain, and you get fed up after a while and lazy or whatever. But if you can teach children, students, or anybody really, that with regards to your particular responsibilities, to be able to find a way of looking at it, an attitude of enjoyment and liking, love for what you're doing, for it in itself, then that power of chanda arises. In the working world, then, you know, the way this, what we often talk about this is the difference between working in order to get your money at the end of the week or the end of the month, and working in order to enjoy, you know, the work as itself, you know, which doesn't mean to say you don't want your wage, but it's not the be all and the end all. And in fact, you might be able to, might be willing to make certain sacrifices in terms of salary, in terms of finding work that you find personally fulfilling. So that would be when your work is motivated by more by chanda than by this tanha or craving. So the what you're doing in itself, with the mind, the craving mind, is merely a pretext or merely something you have to get through in order to get what you really want, which is money, wealth, position, success, and so on. So you don't have that kind of chanta, and so you're always putting off your enjoyment into the future. You know, when I've got this, but and so you're never really experiencing it in the present. I think this is why we talk about materialism. You know, it's an ironic term, because people who are so-called materialists actually have very limited ability to enjoy the material world. You know, it's always what the materialism is going to lead them onto in the future. One of these interesting experiments where they've got two groups of kids to do some kind of puzzle, and group A were given a reward. If you get this puzzle done, then in so much time you get this reward. The other kids were given no reward. And what happened is that the children who were getting the reward did it for the allotted time, and they got their reward and stopped. Whereas the other kids who had no reward just got really into doing the puzzle. And after the time allotted passed, they just carried on doing what they were doing, because they weren't doing it in order to get something. They were doing it and enjoying what they were doing in itself. So in everyday terms, that's a kind of example of kusala. That four factors for success and so on. The second one is wirya, or effort. So this is like right effort being conditioned by this right kind of desire. And then jitta, which means the ability to focus on a task. It's a word very similar to concentration, the ability to sustain attention on a task. And then the fourth term is vimangsa, which is a synonym for wisdom, but it is the aspect of wisdom which is constantly assessing, reassessing one's methodology in order to improve, learning from mistakes, seeing what works, what doesn't work, and gradually refining what one's doing, in this case, how one studies. So those are the four elements. So recap once more. Tanha is always focused on the result, whereas kusala chandra is always focused on the effort. Probably that's easier. Anybody else? Anything else? Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, part of the difficulty of presenting Dhamma, and that time constraints mean that you take one particular aspect, and then in one's real life, then practice, then that's a consideration, and that you're always trying to find that balance. So For instance, if monks are doing a lot of body contemplation, for instance, and looking at the unpleasant aspects of the physical body, then you could very easily get depressed by that. So you want to balance that with some loving kindness meditation or some devotional practices. So this is part of the skill. One of the skills that you develop is that kind of sense of what's going on and is there a balance here? And this is getting too much emphasis on the negative side or being too carried away with the positive side and trying to find that sense of balance. So as regards thinking process, you know, it's important to have that perspective of the non-thinking mind, being able to dwell in the mind that doesn't think at all. So that gives you a sense of the noise element in thought. You know, apart from the content of the thought, whether or not it's useful or not, it is noise. And so some noise you know is useful, but your ability to pursue a line of thought and a theme of contemplation will be much strengthened by the ability you develop in meditation not to think at all or to be able to let go of thinking. The ability to recognize when thought is constructive and when it's destructive, again, is something that you learn as you go along, basically. You start to get more and more sensitive. Oh, I'm getting in a blind alley here. I need to back up and follow a different way. We're talking about the different defilements, and there are lists. I mean, the longest list, and when I give discourses to the monks, it's got 16 different defilements. And you listen to these talks, and most people, it's just like when you read a medical book. You know, as a layman, you read them, and that sounds like me. Yeah, I've got that. You know, it seems like you've got every illness in the book. You know, and so when when you hear these discourses about defilements, you know, oh, that's me. Yeah, that's me. Oh, I'm hopeless. And so I mean, this is a, you know, not obviously the right way to listen to these talks. They're aimed at giving you, as they say, a tool and a more kind of refined map. You know, for instance, if they say to you, okay, go out the front door and walk a mile in that direction and be mindful. You know, okay, your mindfulness will come and go. It's not going to be there all the time. It's about defilements, you know. Oh, that's me. Yeah, that's me. Oh, I'm hopeless. And so I mean, this is a, you know, not obviously the right way to listen to these talks. They're aimed at giving you, as they say, a tool and a more kind of refined map. You know, for instance, if they say to you, okay, go out the front door and walk a mile in that direction and be mindful. You know, okay, your mindfulness will come and go. It's not going to be there all the time. But if I was to say, walk up there and be mindful, be aware of how many trees there are on the left-hand side of the path, how many buildings there are on the right side of the path, how many snakes there are in the, then it's a different kind of awareness. It's a lot sharper and more precise when you have particular things to beware of and particular things to develop. Yeah.
How would you be kind of able to tell your boss that you know that it's actually was wrong and the boss is for the evil, and I know honesty is good, but how to be honest and yet with compassion? And it's very hard when you enjoy your job, but in the meantime you also have to cope with the bottom line of the company.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a little difficult to answer in that, you know, companies and corporations have different kinds of cultures and different kinds of standards of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and what can be spoken about and what cannot be spoken about. And so I don't know your particular situation in itself. But yes, I'm going on to say that the general principle of good communication is that you're specific. You talk about specific problems, not sort of generally, you know, it's just too tense, we're always, you know, being rushed on the bottom line. Or when you speak too generally then about a problem, then somebody in authority will generally just try to defend themselves. It makes people defensive. But if you can speak about one particular problem and be very clear, one, about why you think it's a problem, and secondly, if you can suggest an alternative and asking whether they consider that's a good idea. So always recognizing that they do have that conceit and sense of self, and that if your intention is to get through to them, then you have to use some kind of judo or some, you know, you have to be able to take that into account when you speak to them. But if you make generally, if you make a point about some specific event, some specific project, some specific process that you feel is having a detrimental effect on your performance and on people around you, then it's easier for someone to take that on board. Okay, and of course, the best thing, you know, is when you can you speak in such a way as that your boss just sort of says, "I'll think about that," and then next time you have a meeting, he says it like it's his idea. You see, that's when you've got the technique down. So. Yes.
And then it was so unusual. It was so lovely. And then, wow, my mind stopped. Oh gosh, oh this is great. And obviously,
yeah.
It wasn't stopped anymore. And then I spent the rest of the time trying to get back at all.
I think we've all been through that one, and most people who who've meditated for some time, yeah, and appreciate. I mean, when I was a very young monk, we all, our community, we all went to see Ajahn Chah, and all speaking about this kind of things and meditation, and he said, you know, I feel like daddy taking his kids to the zoo, and he says, "Look at that, an elephant! Look at that!" And he said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah," you know. It's like seen it all before, yeah. Basically, it's just something that you have to go through a few times and until you really see it. It's not going to come back because you want it to come back. Wasting your time and probably wanting it to come back is going to make even more sure that it won't come back. And that just to be patient and to bear with this, and at least to have the gain from it, that kind of confidence that, yeah, I can do this. You know, if the causes and conditions are ripe, the results will come. And you know, you want to be able to derive the benefit of increased commitment and interest and devotion to practice, then something good from that will come. When you do have that kind of experience, it is worthwhile, and you know, in non-meditative, not during the meditation, but afterwards, just to look at the kind of the things that led up to that, the supporting conditions, which you may be able to recreate, you know, without that. Yeah, now I've got it all set up. But you know, there are certain lessons to be learnt about from the times when our mind does become more peaceful. When in the breath meditation, can reach a point where the breath disappears and all sense of the physical body disappears. Just a sense of great bliss or light or this kind of experience. And again, that's very exciting if you've never been through it. It also can be very frightening. So the sense of faith in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha is very, very sustaining here, and to remind yourself that no matter what happens in this meditation, you know, it's not dangerous. You know, all you've got to do is to recognize whatever arises passes away, and it's not who you are. If you can remember that much, you know, there's no danger at all to meditation. But that tendency either to react with excitement or to react with fear are two of the stumbling blocks to the higher levels of meditation. And as I say, almost everyone has to deal with those sooner or later. Yeah, I mean, there's we want to distinguish those kinds of cravings, the craving to have that kind of experience, which is more the Gama Tanha. And then there's the experience of wanting to be someone who's on that level, who can have that kind of experience, you know. And so that's the Bhava Tanha, yes, it is. Any more questions, anybody? Yeah. Well, the a word I used earlier on, you know, sort of modern word, but I think a useful word, is some holistic development, which is to say that one has to develop. Spiritual development includes how one relates to the world that we live in, both the physical world and the social world, as well as the inner emotional, spiritual wisdom development. So it's not really a matter of saying this is more important than that, but they're all part of this kind of mosaic or cluster of dhammas that all work together and reinforce each other. But having said that, certainly mindfulness probably is more prominent in the discourses and is referred to more frequently. And indeed, the Buddha at one point said that just as every curry needs a pinch of salt, then every practice, every Dhamma needs to be accompanied by mindfulness. This was in, you know, the Buddha knew almost everything that needed to be known. I don't think he knew about the detrimental effects of salt in those days, but you know, the simile was that, you know, every single practice requires mindfulness. There again, in the five spiritual powers, or the five spiritual faculties, beginning with faith and then effort, mindfulness, samadhi, calm and tranquility, and wisdom. So you have five. This is quite a very interesting one, because you can look at it like a ladder. So faith, when you have faith, that leads on to effort, to put your faith to the test. And when you try to put your faith to the test by trying to abandon unwholesome dhammas, develop wholesome dhammas, and purify your mind, that effort promotes mindfulness. And when that mindfulness leads to samadhi, and samadhi leads to wisdom. Okay, but there's a second way of looking at these five terms. So you look at it like a seesaw. Okay, so the two outer ones, the first and the fifth, are faith and wisdom. And these have to balance. So if you have an excess of faith but you lack the wisdom, faith can very easily become superstition or fanaticism or like we see in the world today. Okay, if you have too much intellect, too much wisdom, and not enough faith, it becomes very, very dry and overly intellectual, and it lacks that kind of focus and thrust. Then coming inwards, the second and the fourth have to balance, which is the effort and the calm. If there's too much effort and no calm, you get agitated. Too much calm, not enough effort, you can get very lazy or just caught up in something. So then you have the middle factor, which is mindfulness. And so what has to balance mindfulness? Nothing, because mindfulness is the balancing factor. So how do you get the balance between faith and wisdom? Well, through mindfulness. How do you get the balance between effort and calm? Through mindfulness. So if you think of a seesaw, like mindfulness is like the fulcrum, the balance that the others go up and down on. So it's the same idea that the engine, if you like, of spiritual development in the Buddhist idea is mindfulness. So although I say it's not a matter of choosing mindfulness over chanta, but that certainly mindfulness is given a great deal of importance by Buddha. Really, without those qualities, you're not going to have any kind of progress at all, even on the mundane level, let alone on level of enlightenment and so on. These are absolutely essential. So they're just different psychological factors. So, as I say, chanda is the will towards, the will to do, if you like. Whereas mindfulness is the recollection, the non-forgetting of everything that you need to know in the present moment to do what you're doing well. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
When you're meditating on a letter, learning to meditate, you're in a time where whichever problems you may have in mind, you're dwelling on the encroach, come back to the encroach more and more. The best is to stop the meditation.
I think it's better to discipline yourself to keep to the meditation period. You see, I don't think it's very I don't think it's so useful to see meditation as a kind of a problem-solving session. Although it may well occur that during the course of meditation some kind of insight might pop up into your mind. But the goal of meditation is really to take the mind beyond the influence of obsessive thought, of attachment to memory and imagination, and to excitement, depression, doubt, and so on. Being able to sustain attention and to be clear and bright in the present moment, and that effort by taking a particular meditation object, for instance, the breath, is somewhat comparable to establishing like a white screen. When you have a very variegated background, then the appearance of something in your visual field is not always so apparent, and maybe something can come in and out of the visual field without you even noticing it. But once you have a white screen, then it's very much easier to recognize what's going on. And in meditation, we're more interested in seeing process rather than content. In the sense that we're not so interested in, you know, having intelligent thoughts or being able to deal with problems at that particular time. But what we're interested in is being able to have the mindfulness to see a thought as thought. A thought as a particular energy, like a pulse of energy, something that appears and disappears in the mind. So developing a new perspective on mental activity. But once the mind has been trained in that way, as they say, then outside of the meditation period, after you've been meditating for a while, just sitting quietly, that may well be a time in which you may take up some particular problem or some particular issue. And when the mind is that much more clear and stable than it may usually be, it may well be a very constructive time for addressing those particular issues that you're interested in. But I don't think that it's a good habit to get into or to stop the meditation when some interesting thought arises and then go and see to it, because that way it's very difficult for any real depth of meditation to be realized. Is that... Yes. I think in the beginning it's good to have a set time, to be a little bit disciplined about it, and even if it means just sitting there and looking out the window until the time has elapsed, but just to make a point that I'm not going to get up until that time has elapsed. Once you've been meditating for a while and you have a certain proficiency, then you may well get to the point where it's more of a problem, you know, getting up, that you don't want to get up anymore. But you've got to go to work or you've got to go and do something else. But even if you haven't reached that period, then at least if you're not going to be jumping up after a few minutes because of some pain, some discomfort, some irritation, or something or other, because our minds are very tricky, and they can find all kinds of rational reasons to stop meditating. So, I mean, often if people ask me in its initial stages, what is a measure of success in meditation? I'm saying the willingness to keep doing it. I mean, if you've got that, if you can maintain that practice, even if sometimes it just feels like an empty chore, then you are creating the causes and conditions for success further along the way. Well, our mind is knows extremes. We know the extreme of thought and endless thought, agitation in the mind, and we know the dull and sleepy state. And so the challenge in meditation is to develop the ability to dwell in that state which is neither agitated nor sleepy. This is the state of mindfulness and awareness. Now, in the effort to develop that state, you're going to have difficulties. If you fail, you're either going to fall into the extreme of agitation or extreme of dullness. In the beginning, when people first start to meditation, the main problem is agitation. But then when you push past agitation, then the dullness becomes more and more of a problem. Okay, so it's basically natural to everyone in meditation that they have to, sooner or later, they have to deal with these things. So if we develop, we're developing mindfulness, and then we lack the experience and the power of mind to be able to sustain mindfulness, then the mind sinks down, and so that that's why we need this accompanying factor of sampajanya, or clear comprehension, which is like keeps an eye on the mindfulness and makes sure that it doesn't sink. Okay, so the simile, one simile the Buddha gave is someone is walking with a big bowl of oil like this, and on one side there's like beauty queen. And on the other side, a sort of crowd of people shouting. And then behind is a man holding a sword, executioner. And if one drop comes down, they chop off his head, you see. So try and imagine yourself in that situation. And what kind of attention would you need to save your life? Okay, I think most of your attention would be on holding that ball steady, wouldn't it? Because it's only got to waver a little bit and that's it. But at the same time, you would also, I think, every now and again, just have to glance ahead to see the path you're walking on, to make sure that it's level, that there are no bumps, or because even if you're holding this very well, you come to a step, or you come to a hole in the ground, and it's all going to fall. So the mindfulness is like holding that jar and holding it still and steady and keeping your mind on it. But the clear comprehension is that sort of just checking on the path and the context in which you are developing mindfulness. So one way of talking about sampajanya, or clear comprehension, is context. Being aware of context. Many years ago, when I was abbot of the monastery in Ubon, one of the monks was learning the Patimokkha, you know, which is one of the things young monks have to learn by heart, and it's a very long chant, 45 minutes you chant by yourself. It's very difficult to learn. And so he was in his kuti at night time chanting the Patimokkha. He goes, like this. And he was very diligent and really put a lot of effort into this. But then I started getting other monks coming and complaining. In the night time, when they want to meditate, there's the sound of this monk chanting very loudly. And so I spoke to this monk, and he felt very noi jai, kind of, what can you say, like piqued him. He said, but I was so mindful, you know. I was putting so much effort in. I just get criticized, you know. And he's saying, yeah, you're very mindful of the chanting, but you were not aware of the context in which you were chanting and the effect on other people. So this would be another example of having the sati, or mindfulness, but not the clear comprehension, the awareness of the context in which you are being mindful. So if you're putting effort into mindfulness, then it's very easy for the mind to sink. And so the sampajanya, this is wakefulness, being awake with the meditation, is very important. Now, something that seems attitude to meditation, which seems to encourage this dullness or sinking, is one where you don't give importance to this sampajanya and wakefulness. And secondly, in which your attitude is too much of pushing and concentrating and using effort and using will on the meditation. That seems to make this dull state of mind more likely to arise. And I think this is what Ajahn is criticizing. So I think we must distinguish between like the wrong attitude to meditation and the technique itself. I don't think that it's fair to criticize the particular technique of, say, breath meditation, but merely that people approach it in the wrong way sometimes. Sometimes, you know, when you're meditating, sometimes like a word that you kind of like release into the meditation. It can be a word like let go if there's too much holding, but also in like dern you, ru you, like something like this, just to bring your mind back. Yes, how awake is the mind? How bright is the mind? Just sometimes just to have a little word just to check. This is the wisdom faculty, which in this particular case we call sampajanya. Yeah, okay. Yes.
Steep slope. The more in my posture, I slump.
Yeah.
And the more, and it just seems to be a natural result of relaxing into the meditation. But all of a sudden, I find my spine curve, my muscles in my thighs tiring. And then I adjust my posture upward. And the longer the meditation goes on, the greater the struggle.
Yeah.
Sometimes I find it's much easier to study this wall, for example, but I was wondering if you had some tips.
Yeah, I mean, only to the extent that you want to get into that mindset of struggle and fight, because that tends to be not very constructive. And to have that sense of kindness and wishing well to your body, and you say, yeah, well, this is how it is right now. It can only do this much, you know, and do your best, you know. But there should be, a certain amount of patient effort to gradually increase the length of time that you can maintain the posture. As I said earlier, just as with any kind of exercise, you just push in the envelope just a little bit. So, and then you can, you know, you can feel, you can see over a period of weeks or months that there's a definite improvement. But sometimes, just go and sit against the wall. You know, don't feel guilty about it, or you know, I'm bad because I sit against the wall sometimes. You know. But just that, you know, having as a goal, you know, that you're trying to develop that ability to sit longer. But every now and again, yeah, it is quite nice just to sit against a wall. And you don't want to get into the habit of looking on meditation as this kind of tough kind of, you know, chore that it's good for me, you know, you know, got to do it. But you've got to be able to really sustain that sense of enjoyment, seeing the value of it. And if you push too much and you're dealing with physical pain and too much, you start to get negative towards it, and then the results are not very good. And when the results are not very good, then it undermines the effort even more, and you get into this sort of vicious downward spiral. So you know, you do what you can and try different things out. It's all a matter of exploration and trying stuff out, and not thinking there's a fixed way of doing it, because everyone's different, everyone's bodies are different, and different skillful means can work. Some work for some people and not for others, or work for a certain period of time and then don't work so well anymore. And that's all about how you learn about yourself through meditation. So it's not just a simple thing, you meditate in order to become peaceful and you know, following the sort of so many steps to enlightenment, but it's an ongoing process in which you're learning about yourself, and how do you deal with, you know, how do you deal with it when your body doesn't do the things that you want it to do? You know, what does that bring up? And that's also part of the meditation. Okay, that's like all the questions. The last few occasions, after we finished, people who are not rushing off want to go for a walk and just enjoy the countryside and the fresh air for half an hour or something, then I'm very happy to take you for a shortish walk up to the Hermitage where I live. Leave that up to you. If you'd like, you're very welcome. Otherwise, we can end the session right now.